Hey everyone, this is Aiden Walker. I am joined by Justin Ohalik and Laura Weiser. We are second year medical students at the University of North Carolina, here talking about vaccine hesitancy in the COVID-19 pandemic and how the perception of COVID-19 information impacts communities differently.
Justin here. So about a year ago, there was a study in North Carolina gauging interest in a vaccine among underserved populations at COVID testing sites. 68% reported hesitancy, with the majority, about 51%, citing safety as the chief reason. And if we look today at the North Carolina COVID dashboard, we still see some counties with vaccination rates lower than 40%. But the study is significant because I think it reflects something that we already know, that there are communities which our healthcare resources don't adequately reach. And the same study noted that a majority of respondents, about 63%, said they would trust their healthcare provider's recommendation about the vaccine. So as future providers, we ask, how can we better reach these communities? And today we talked to two guests who are leading the way, reaching communities with information visualizations tailored to address the concerns of each individual.
Laura here. We had the great opportunity to interview two health informatics researchers and practicing nurses, Dr. Adriana Arcia, Associate Professor of Nursing at Columbia University, and Dr. Suzanne Bakken, Professor of Biomedical Informatics at Columbia University. Their work is focused on creating informative, individualized health infographics tailor-made for various diverse communities.
So I thought maybe we could start by just talking a little bit about the ReadyViz toolbox and kind of maybe just in a one or two sentence, what is it exactly?
Yeah, I'd like to start maybe with a little bit about how we got there. So about a decade ago, we had a large community-based project, and our motivation for starting to do information visualization was really motivated by the fact that we wanted to give research results back to research participants in a manner in which they could understand them. And because we had conducted a survey with about 6,000 people in Washington Heights, primarily Latino, many preferred Spanish as a language, we also had data that suggested that people had low levels of health literacy. So we knew to start, if we wanted to give results back, that we really needed to go with a visualization approach. And so through the years, we conducted a set of projects from that. And Adriana can talk a little bit more about that. But the idea to do this for COVID-19 was really to pull together all the hard lessons that we'd learned through the years in doing this type of research and pull it into a toolbox that could be used by a variety of stakeholders, including community-based organizations, clinicians, healthcare organization. And so the toolbox includes information about some of those hard lessons, but an important part of it, consistent with our work in tailoring other types of things, is a software framework that takes information from something like a survey and matches it up with our graphical repository to create some tailored infographics. And I think Dr. Arcia could talk more about the graphical part and specifically the infographic components of that, of the ReadyViz toolbox.
Sure. I think when most people think of infographics, they're thinking of what I call generic infographics, where it's the same for every viewer. Sorry about that, where it's the same for every viewer. And so with a tailored infographic, we're taking some information that we have about the viewer, such as their COVID test result, and we're showing it back to them. We're including it in the infographic. And so we need software to help us generate those images. And we've developed software in the past, but it's not really ready for prime time. And what this ReadyViz Toolbox project allows us to do is not only to understand what are the information needs in our community related to COVID testing and vaccination, but they also allow us to design those infographics and house them in an infrastructure, a digital infrastructure that allows not only us and our, internal way of tailoring the infographics, but allows other people to do that in a self-service manner. So the toolbox will contain tools for people to generate the infographics based on their local needs, but also tools for methodology. So all of, guides to all of the methods that we use from beginning to end of the process.
So with regard to tailoring these infographics for users versus institutions, I guess I'm trying to think from the perspective of, say, for example, a nursing mother, how are they interacting with the visualization itself? Is it something that's like on their phone? Is it on like their health provider's website?
So we want to create something that's very flexible so that, for example, they, their clinician could have it on this like a kind of like a plugged into their website and already tailored to some extent for that organization. But then the person could go in and say, okay, tick boxes, these are my top three concerns. You could have something that's, that something that's mediated by a staff member. So for instance, maybe they have a tablet and they're talking to people as they're coming in and they're saying, okay, what are your top three? They punch it into the tablet and print something out. So I think there's a lot of different options. We're trying to make something that's very flexible.
And so we really think about it is it's really an information visualization module. Mm-hmm. And it can be used as a standalone, module. Or it could be connected with other types of digital modules as well. If someone wanted to display it through some type of interface and a variety of things. So we're really agnostic, but focusing on the function of the ReadyViz toolbox as a module, as it takes as input a set of data. It runs software we call ENTICE, which stands for Electronic Tailored Infographics for Community Engagement, Education, and Empowerment. To do that tailoring, and then the output is the visualization, and people can do whatever they wish with that visualization. They could use it standalone. They could do these at scale, or pamphlets and that kind of thing, or they could produce it. Put it in somebody's personal health record. We're open to a variety of use cases. From what I see mainly in the New York City context is so much of going this last, I'm not sure how many miles, with the very hesitant populations, that there may be a lot of that will end up being produced by high tech, but really being something that actually might be on paper that they use with some populations. Most of the outreach in New York City is for traditionally underserved populations is through community health workers that have strong ties to the community. And they may be out there on corners and knocking on doors and other kinds of things where they wouldn't necessarily have, the technology would have produced something tailored for the community or for their organization, but they won't, but they might actually be using paper in what they're doing one-on-one with someone.
So maybe we can expand the conversation a little bit, because I know that we are also interested in the way that information is communicated, not just like from provider to patient or healthcare provider to patient, but also just within communities. Is there some way that you see this toolbox, or do you have any ideas about how to kind of expand the communication so that people are sharing like these same visualizations and understanding with each other?
I think it's important to recognize that although the current issue is COVID, that moving forward, there will be other concerns, whether they be, you know, our continuing, you know, issues with chronic health or, you know, the next pandemic, God forbid, right? So when we have infrastructure that allows us to create high quality materials quickly and to tailor them for the local needs, then I think that opens up a lot of avenues for moving faster, because the disinformation spreads so quickly, and creating high quality, correctly informative information, it does take a little bit of time. You want to make sure that it's thoughtful, that it's well designed, and it's not as quick as that disinformation. So any infrastructure that we can put in to help us shorten that time frame, I think that also has value.
So Dr. Arcia, you had mentioned sort of the importance of having an established infrastructure to tackle, you know, what you could say are almost anticipated issues or things that may arise with a future pandemic, a future vaccine, chronic health conditions. I know that you have an extensive history working in maternity care. And I sort of think of, especially with vaccines, like the issue of, you know, fertility or birth defects is it not just a COVID vaccine hesitancy specific issue, but something that has recurred for years and years. I mean, with vaccines, you could go back to like Wakefield and the autism link he tried to make with the MMR vaccine. You could also go back to like forced sterilizations, especially in a place like North Carolina, as a source of, you know, just general medical mistrust for pregnant women or women hoping to become pregnant. So could you maybe just talk a little bit more about how y'all have in the past or in the future tailor this sort of system towards maternity care and folks who are thinking about becoming pregnant or are pregnant?
So something important to remember about information related to pregnancy, childbirth, childbearing in general, is that this is a transient demographic, in the sense that people have a season in their life in which they start to think, oh, this is an issue for me. I need to start thinking about this. And it is an active interest. It is a pressing interest. And then eventually that season ends. And so you have to think about making sure that those resources are available for when people start to need them, right? In terms of trust, the reason we are doing this as more of an organizational thing is because of those trust issues, right? Because there's plenty of stuff online that's tailored, you know, that's targeted to the individual, but for the average individual, especially if they're not super internet savvy, their ability to evaluate the quality of the information is going to vary. And sometimes the misinformation is obviously not very good, but sometimes it is pretty slick. So that's why we're relying on those community-based organizations that have the trust of the local community, right? People may not trust the US COVID task force. They may not trust the CDC, and they may not trust their state health department, but they do trust, you know, the person who's down the block, who's always there with information when they need it. And that is really the thinking behind having this tailoring at the local community level.
I have another question, kind of going back to like distrust of the government kind of at a national level and like the US COVID task force. That, like, you guys are doing a great job with this project. Like, it's really incredible that you're doing all this and like partnering with communities and community leaders to kind of tailor these infographics to the specific needs of the community. And obviously that's very necessary because there are so many tons of diverse communities within this ginormous nation of the United States. What role do you see the US government having in the future as far as like
how centralized or decentralized should they be making their like information output, and like how has the government failed or succeeded in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic? Like, has it been too outsourced to like these outside institutions with not enough assistance from the government? But then you run to the risk of if it's too centralized and like too kind of hands-on with the government, that there might be mistrust with different communities. So like, what do you see, how do you see like partnering with the government in the future, and like what role do you see it playing in the future?
Well, there's a lot of good questions there. There's multiple things that I can address. One is, you know, to what extent do people trust the U.S. COVID task force, for instance? And granted, these are only very preliminary data from 343 of our participants, but we see that 64% either trust the US COVID task force either somewhat or a great deal. So there is some level of trust already there. People's own doctor or healthcare provider comes in number one at 74%, but the US government in general is coming in at 55%. So there is some level of trust. In terms of what the US government has done or could do, really what we need is a very strong public health infrastructure so that once there is a message, that it can be disseminated quickly and effectively. The fact that people at the beginning of the pandemic were relying on fax machines to move data around is insane, right? And it speaks to the chronic underfunding of our public health system over the last however many years. So that is a very important thing moving forward, is making sure that we're able to move those data around, understand what the trends are at the local level so that we can apportion resources effectively. Now, in terms of messaging, one of the things that we heard a lot amongst our participants was that one of the things that really was driving their distrust was that they felt that the message was inconsistent and that it kept changing. And to some extent, that's unavoidable because our knowledge keeps changing, right? At first we knew nothing, and then we, you know, learned a little bit, and now we know a lot more. But being able to be transparent about that, like, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, but also to try to be as consistent as possible in the messaging, that is very important. And so having that infrastructure where you can disseminate a consistent message and then have that message go that last mile in the community in the ways that the community most trusts is important. So as we were talking to the participants, I had this image, you know, we were asking people, do they trust Dr. Fauci, for instance? And I had this image of a whole team of scientists, clinicians in their, you know, white coats that are each deputized to talk to their local communities. So if somebody, you know, can, you know, a physician, a nurse, somebody who can address, you know, Cuban Americans in Southern Florida in the terms that Cuban Americans in Southern Florida are going to understand and appreciate, and but have that, have them be bringing that centralized, consistent, evidence-based message. So we need a team of Dr. Fauci's, one for every community.
And the hope is that the ReadyViz toolbox is going to play a role kind of in this, in having, being able to disseminate that common message, but tailored.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead,
Sue. And one of the things for, in the, as I've listened to people from other parts of the country, in some instances, so much of the COVID testing and the vaccination has been through more healthcare provider organizations. But in New York City, it really is very much something that's done in the community. And I'm not quite sure how many, I probably have had at least maybe 25 COVID tests. I haven't gotten one from a healthcare provider yet. It's been in a mobile van. So our perspective was very aligned with the approach in New York City in particular, which was very boots on the ground, out in the community, community health workers, lots of mobile vans out in areas that are communities that were particularly had more COVID-related morbidity and mortality. And in some ways, I can remember a couple of participants in particular, they were a little worried about the amount of attention in their community because of some of the things that I think it was maybe Aiden was talking about, some of the historic distrust and structural racism and those kinds of things. And all of a sudden, when people in Harlem are the first to get the vaccine, that brings up the question, is it really ready for prime time? Or are we the guinea pigs for this? And so it's just something that has to constantly be considered. And that also is once again, just another part that makes it so important to be working with those trusted people in the community. So we as, you know, the people from the university can be the generators and the tailoring of the evidence with the strong engagement with the community, but we use our community-based organizations to recruit participants. We get them because of their trust in them to work in our project. And so that's just been essential. And I think one of the things that's been impressive to me about RADx Up is I've been involved, I'd say, in some initiatives where there's at least, there'll be the language of community engagement and community-based participatory research, but then it really doesn't truly play out in the type of projects that they choose. With RADx Up, they were very clear that the project had to have strong community engagement in their directions for these grants. They made it that very clear on the technical sessions, and looking at the groups that they've decided to fund, I think it does show a true commitment to working closely with the community to address this important health problem.
Well, thank you, Drs. Arcia and Dr. Bakken. In our social and health systems course, we've discussed a lot about the history and sort of the source of health disparities within marginalized populations. And I think one of the places that we've been stuck in our class discussions is kind of what to do about it. So it's been really cool to see and hear from you both about a strategy to help eliminate these disparities. Thank you.
Thanks for asking.
And knowing that when we air this podcast, the immediate audience for it will be second year medical students, which we're sort of at that stage in our medical education where they're about to send us, you know, off into the world, off into the clinics, off actually interacting with like real patients on a daily basis. So if there are any like final parting words or thoughts or advice you would have for us, I'm sure that would be very appreciated.
Yeah, we probably each have some. And so whenever you're working with communities, we always talk about cultural humility and really trying to understand where people are coming from. And I think that's part of being a humanitarian clinician, regardless of your discipline. I guess the other thing that I talk about when I talk about informatics to medical students is the notion of what we do in ReadyViz Toolbox and other types of efforts that we've developed is we really are building our expertise into the technology. And so something like ReadyViz Toolbox reflects our perspective with our experience in having a kind of a holistic approach to working with patients and communities, as well as experience in patient education that is part of our nursing training. So although we don't consider it's not a nursing system, we have put that kind of expertise into the technology. And so my lesson is, as clinicians, you need to think about the types of digital tools you can use to be an extension of your expertise, because you're not going to be able to physically do everything you might like to do one-to-one. So what information prescription can you perhaps give to someone so that they have follow-up information? After all, if you're engaging in, you will no doubt at some time be asked to provide input to the design of something, on an electronic health record or a patient portal or something. How do you bring your expertise and build your perspective and your knowledge into something that will live beyond you? So I hope when you get some of those opportunities, you'll say yes rather than no.
I'm going to give sort of a bigger picture answer than that. I've spent a lot of time thinking about what competencies the patient needs to have, whether they be knowledge, skills, or abilities, to make the most of whatever care is available to them. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this specifically in the context of maternity care, like what skills do maternity clients need to be able to do their part towards the best outcome that they can have. And what I see is that the competencies they need depend heavily upon their context. So if the system is demanding competencies of them that they do not have, that's a problem. There's a mismatch. So oftentimes what we do as clinicians is we try to skill people up. We try to say, here's how to inject your insulin. Here's how to use a condom. Here's how to do this, 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 and this. We're trying to skill them up, and we're not taking enough time to reduce the burden and demand less of people or demand different kinds of things of people. And so where this visualization fits in is that we're reducing that reading level burden while also leveraging people's existing skills in visual analysis and in cultural associations with images. So as you go into your clinical practice, think about where can you reduce the burden. Visualizations are just one way, but doing that requires a strong theory of mind where you are able to step back and really remember that the person doesn't have all of the same knowledge that you do. And I don't mean that in the sense of they don't have the clinical knowledge. You can be giving a clinical presentation to your colleagues and remember that they don't know what you're going to say. You know what you're going to say, but they don't know what you're going to say. And so therefore you have to give the information in a particular way that's going to be useful and helpful to them. Having that theory of mind about your patients and what is it that they don't know that they are going to need to know to be able to move forward. And how do you scaffold that information to bring them along, you know, as easily as possible? So that would be my advice. Think about where you can reduce the burden and bring people along in a conversational way. Remember also the power differential that exists in that room, right? And how difficult it can be to speak up. Like, I am highly educated, high self-efficacy, I'm a researcher, I even spend time thinking about these issues. And I have even had moments as a patient where I felt like I couldn't speak up for myself. Imagine someone who doesn't have the same language skills, doesn't have the same amount of education, and is not documented, maybe has concerns about their status. Like, all of those things play a role. So always remember that power differential is there and do what you can to help patients find their own power. So that's my advice.